So let's talk then about what our ultimate goal is. And awesome librarians is what we're going to talk about. Now, because like we're totally awesome, for sure. But this actually, there's two lines that we take away as we've been preparing and planning this process that I want to explain a bit. The first is our goal is awesome librarians, not awesome projects. Now, we would love awesome projects, and you guys are going to produce awesome projects. But we're much more interested in what you learn and can take away. What is it? Now, we're not going to sit there and say, oh, boy, they used that website wrong, or gee, why did they use this blog for it? What we really are going to work on is trying to make sure that you guys are courageous and innovative and not scared of the technology so you can get onto the good stuff, which is leading to making communities better. Which is where the second line comes in. We need to build conversations, not websites. It's going to be really tempting if you sit and listen to all these tools and all these gadgets and all these pieces to think about how do we slap this on there and how do we slap this on there. Anyone remember, like, when the web first came out, you were doing HTML, and you discovered the flash tag? Right, the flash tag was a tag you put around text that made it blink on and off. Normally, red text on a blue background. As if to say, if you're an epileptic, please, come back to my show. I mean, even Timothy Leary was going, oh, God, I don't get it, right? So, the point is, there's going to be lots of features and gadgets and all that wonderful stuff, and you can walk out of here with a beautiful Red 2.0 site that no one gives a damn about, that doesn't really solve a problem, that doesn't really represent the community. So what we're going to spend a lot of time stressing is, what does that community need? In the second session, we'll do more on technology. In the intersession, we'll have lots of stuff on technology. But first, we have to prime it. And so what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time today talking about what I mean, what is an awesome librarian? What does it mean to be an awesome librarian? Now, that talking about producing awesome librarians is really the height of arrogance. Because we're talking about a profession that has a 3,000-year-long history. Right? So there might have been one or two awesome librarians in that time. Right? If you think about it, we are one of the oldest professions out there. If we're not the oldest profession, we organize the books of the people who belong to the oldest profession. Where can I get that information about brothels in the South? Are those current brothels or just different audience? You probably, if you've gone to library school at some point, let me just get this out of the way. If you're in this room, you're a librarian. If you say, but Dave, I didn't go to library school. Take a moment with me. You're a librarian. Because the way that I define librarianship... Oh, I'm sorry. There's some more I probably don't know. But the way I define a librarian is someone who engages in that profession. It's for 3,000 years. Librarians have been trying to figure out what it means to be a librarian. How do we serve? What do we do? It's a tradition that goes back to the idea of scrolls and cuneiform tablets. At some point, we chained books to shelves, and then we decided to bring them down. We opened them up. We lent them. That conversation of, is that what a library is? Is that what a librarian is? That conversation, people who engage in it and are willing to advance it, I consider librarians. And by you folks coming into this room and engaging in that challenge, you are taking up that conversation. Now, some of you may have heard this history in library school, and it probably went something like this. Way back in Egypt, there was this thing called the Library of Alexandria. That seems to be where we all point to. And it was big, and it had lots of stuff, and it had all the information from the known world, and this is really cool. And then, depending on whether you're anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, someone came in and burned it down. I mean, I swear, you read it like, well, the Christian hordes came in. You watch that horrible horror movie. Or it was the caliphate of so-and-so, or I don't know. But someone that you hated destroyed this building. A few pieces escaped, and then we somehow jumped right to the Middle Ages, where we had monks toiling away copying manuscripts, right? And so this, where we preserved knowledge, and they were kept in abbeys and such, and so the Enlightenment could come about. And then, once again, we skip, because we're Americans, right to America, where, as we all know, Benjamin Franklin created the first public library, and yay! This is a history you may have heard something about. I want to give you an alternative view of that history for a moment. I'll start in the Library of Alexandria as well. Now, what many people don't know when they hear about the Library of Alexandria is that, in fact, it wasn't a building. It's not what we would have thought of as a bunch of columns with a bunch of scrolls in it. It was a campus. In fact, the first building that they built in Alexandria wasn't the library. It was a building dedicated to the muses, called the Musée, which is where we get the term museum. In fact, what the library was as much a dormitory as it was a repository. The Library of Alexandria was one of the first economic development activities in history. What happened were the leaders of the city-state of Alexandria would bring scholars from around the ancient world, let them live tax-free in the library, where they would interact with other scholars through colonnades. And once they came up with a brilliant, interesting idea, they might write it down, in which case they'd take the scroll and either drop it to the corner or take it to the musée. But they would learn and listen. In fact, the librarian of Alexandria was one of the closest confidants of the kings of Alexandria. The librarian of Alexandria wasn't someone who maintained the stuff. It was someone who advised the state. So the Library of Alexandria was not about the stuff in it, but the stuff that came out of it and, taking Mary's point, the impact of that stuff. Now, once again, things get burned, things blow up. Pick evil dictator of the day. Library blows up. Most of the collection actually survived but was dispersed. And a large part of that collection ended up here in Muslim Spain, in the Iberian Peninsula. And so what happens is the Pope has a problem. The Pope has a problem in that all the noblemen of Europe are busy killing each other. And he says, I need something to get rid of them. Go free Spain. And the first crusade starts. Now, ironically, it wasn't really the Christian crusaders. All the Christian noblemen hired Muslim crusaders to go liberate Toledo. And so it looked much less like bang, 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 and much more like, ha, can I come in here? And what the crusaders discovered when they went into Iberian Spain was they found library after library after library. This one library had more volumes in it than every manuscript and book in France at the time. And another amazing thing was happening is that they were being used on a regular basis to come up with these wacky things like the number zero, to come up with these interesting things like algebra, to revolutionize architecture. And what happened was that once they found them, most of the texts were original Greek texts that had been translated into Arabic. They would hire translators to come in, and they would translate these texts into European languages and Latin. And suddenly, noblemen would come and learn and begin hiring tutors to come and teach them the text, because the noblemen realized, looking at law, looking at engineering, looking at math, they could actually extend their reach and their power within Europe. And the tutors they hired, which tended to be monks, actually, they eventually said, well, if we're all hiring this guy, let's just build a building and pay once. And that became the origin of the university. Now, I'm going to skip ahead as well, and I'm going to go to Philadelphia as well, but I'm not going to go to Ben Franklin. Because it turns out Benjamin Franklin did not create the first public library in the United States. Benjamin Franklin created a subscription library. He basically had a bunch of friends, they had too many books, and they wanted to share them, so they rented out a spot, brought their collections together, and you had to pay to get in. The first public library in Philadelphia was the Free Library of Philadelphia, created by this man, whose name is, I swear to God, Dr. Pepper. Turns out Dr. Pepper had a rich uncle who was also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and they created the first public library as a service to the citizens, to increase the knowledge of the citizens and participation in democracy. Now, this is two views of history, but they have something very different. They have something that's different between them, a worldview. Instead of talking about collection, library as collection, it's library as scholarship. It's library as learning. It's library as knowledge. Instead of talking about dissemination and access, it's action. Simply having the greatest collection on earth locked away under a vault in Bethesda does not equal scholarship and learning and impact. What the Library of Philadelphia that I love a lot has this beautiful collection of special collections on the fifth floor. You take an elevator to the fifth floor, you hit a buzzer, and you wait up to 20 minutes for someone to come and let you in. Now, that's preserving treasure. That's not necessarily promoting access or knowledge or learning. So we need to talk about moving from sharing access to that of a social good, of a public good. Now, the difference here is worldview. The difference here is not the technology. It's not the events. It's why I love history. I'm very bad at it, but I love history. Because history is not a set of events that happen one after another. History is an ongoing conversation about how we make sense of today. It's what items we pick up, how we relate them together. And so we can go back to history, and we can talk about this is knowledge as thing versus knowledge as action. Let's go back in history, and we'll go back to Alexandria, which is right about there. And the Library of Alexandria was also interesting for another reason. The Library of Alexandria was interesting because it was on a major seaport, on a major trade route. In fact, my favorite story about the library is that whenever a ship would sail in and dock, they would send soldiers down to the ship, and they would confiscate every document on the ship, take them back to the library, copy them, and give the copies back to the ship. I mean, come on. This is great. When people come in and you check their bags to make sure they're not taking stuff in or taking stuff out, you need to check their bags to see what you can keep. Oh, I read that one, yeah. Did you see that iPod? Oh, this app. Thank you very much, right? Well, there was a problem with trade, which is the way that trade worked was that trade became vital along the seacoast. And what would happen is that people leaving Europe and people leaving around the Mediterranean, they really couldn't navigate very well. They eventually used the stars to figure out where they were east, north, and south. But they had to stay close to the land and use land marks to know where they were. If they couldn't see that cliff or that lighthouse or certain information, they might as well have sailed off the edge of a flat earth. Which, by the way, Christopher Columbus did not figure out it was round. Aristotle did. I mean, he had a globe on the boat that came over. Right? But this idea that early navigation was moving around the coast, and they had charts and such, and they could see where they were going north and south. But they didn't know how to get east and west, because it turns out the stars suck at east and west. What's called longitude. It wasn't until the 18th century and a big sort of massive X Prize event that someone invented a clock that was accurate enough that they could determine longitude. Now, my point of that is this idea, these lines that you've seen growing up on a map, don't exist. You don't walk through Brazil and trip every so often. You can't drive your car along the equator. They're made up. They represent, quite literally, a worldview, a view of the world, and a worldview that is so powerful that we still use it today, that at the time it created a massive amount of trade that suddenly could cross oceans, that could go all the way to China and back, that could go south of the equator. That was the creation of how people thought about the world, not how the world worked. That's how important it is when we look at the future of librarianship, to have a worldview. Because if we don't have a worldview, if we don't have a concept of where we're going, then we have to stay close to the land. We have to wait for the landmarks. And in technology, what that means is we wait for Google to tell us what's next. We wait for Amazon to tell us what's next. Oh, Google thinks it's important, let's do it. That's a landmark. That's going this far off the coast because you're afraid you're going to fall off. What we need is a worldview powerful enough that we can navigate into that future, navigate things we never expected, have whole new notions of where we go. That's the worldview that we need to develop so that we can have a map. By the way, this idea became so powerful, we use it to this day. Many of you probably used it to get here. It's called GPS. You just replace the moon and stars with satellites. And the clock is a small little quartz clock that sits in there and determines how far you are away from those things. So, do we have a GPS-like worldview of our profession? Or are we so mired in what we do and how we do it, the functions of what we do, that we never get to the point of dreaming what the future is? The future of my profession hinges not on what Amazon does or what HarperCollins does with a 26th limit checkout on ebooks. It rests on our shoulders to say, you know what, HarperCollins? Turns out we don't need you. Or we have the powerful power enough to explain why you need us. So what are we going to base this worldview on? Well, classically, librarians have based a worldview on something called documentalism. See, you thought you were coming to an academic foreign conference, but you are. Documentalists would start in Europe is the idea that knowledge is in the things, the containers. So we're documentalists. And so let's go back to Alexandria again, where we find this nice little piece. Isis breastfeeding Osiris. What I want you to think about with this object is, what is it? Well, some people are going to look at it and they can understand the composition of it. It's a piece of bronze. And the bronze can be dated. We can know accurately where it was created. We can even tell by its molecular structure how it was forged. We understand a lot about this thing. And a historian might look at this and say, statuettes representing Isis suckling her son Horus, were very common among the late period figurines and were made of bronze and glazed compositions. So they can look at this and identify when it came from and maybe what cultural significance is. But while not necessarily now, but at some point in the past, people looked at this as a god, as a religious symbol. Right? When you look at the Gutenberg Bible, people look at that and say, it's the origin of printing. Someone might look at it and say, it's a couple million dollars. And sometimes the people look at it and say, this is the truth that God gave us. And what's amazing is all of those may be true. But its composition, its historical context, its religion, doesn't come from the object. It comes from us looking at the object. Right? When you look at this, it's Purdy. Right? There's nothing in that statue that says, I'm Purdy. Right? It's something that we bring to it. Right? And what's amazing is, if I just dug this up on the side street, I would have no idea what it is. Right? So the object itself is not the knowledge. The books that you have on your shelves, the DVDs, the databases, all that is not knowledge. It's artifacts. It's stuff. It's a tool to get to a larger goal. The larger goal is ultimately how we needs to be based on how we understand the world. Because if we don't have a worldview that's based on how people understand the world, how they work, then what we're doing is constantly trying to catch up. Why should we use Facebook? Why should we tweet? Why should we do Google Wave?
Yeah.
Why? My library, you heard my first Facebooker in Illinois? Were you first on Friendster?
I was on Friendster as well.
Yeah, not so much, right? Yeah. But what's interesting is, were you on MySpace early?
I didn't like MySpace.
Yeah, it sucks. But the thing is, well, someone once said, well, Facebook beat MySpace. No. MySpace won first. Facebook won second. What is it that's common that makes these things stick, that makes it worth our time, that makes it valuable, that makes it rightly so? Something to brag about being early to that game. Why? Is it because Mark Zuckerberg said so? Did you see the social network? Now I'm going to get myself in trouble if I talk about that scene. Anyway, how many websites have I created? So what is it? If the knowledge isn't here, or it's not in our books, or it's not our things, or it's not what we buy from HarperCollins or buy from Overdrive, where is it? It's up here. And we have to understand that if we understand how people think, if we understand how people know, we can build better tools and better systems. And how do people learn? Well, it turns out they learn through conversation. What do I mean? Well, when you seek to understand something, when you seek to engage something, you enter into a conversation. Most of those conversations are with yourself. If you're sitting there going, what is this guy doing? Who are you talking to? Okay. When you read a book, you're not having a conversation with the author. If you didn't understand Hamlet, Bill Shakespeare's not standing by to help you through. He's dead. You're not having a conversation with the book. It's a bunch of dead trees. Or, as we have some devices in the back, it's a bunch of ones and zeros on a screen. You're having a conversation with yourself. Do I believe it? Do I understand it? Does it make sense? And by the way, this isn't a non-fiction fiction thing. Some of the things we learn most about ourselves come from fiction. Am I the catcher in the rye? Right? What, you know, call me Ishmael. Why? Anyway, this conversation consists of who's in that conversation. So when you try and understand the world, when you try and understand your need that you're going to fulfill through this project, who are you talking to? Yourselves? Who are the other conversants that need to be at that table? If you're going to solve questions like the unemployment issue and job training, are you the folks, the only folks who need to do this? I was in a really interesting meeting where they said, we need to teach people not how to get jobs, but how to make their own. We need to teach people how to be entrepreneurs. We need to teach people to quit their jobs and go make their own business. And I asked you, how many librarians do you know that have quit their jobs and gone and started their own business that are currently working at your library? So who has? What can we add to that conversation? How can we be part of it? If what you learn in this session is how to build a really cool website and how to make it really flashy and look nice, and you get your community to look at it when you're done and go, it does look nice, you fail. If you built a beautiful website, you fail. I know Ann said you're not allowed to fail. You fail. Because it's not about the website, it's about the conversation. And some of those conversations, and the ones we're going to talk about, technology can bring a lot to. But just, you know, a little side note, some of them, technology can help you not at all. In fact, it can drive people away in some ways. The point of this is not get rid of your buildings and just go virtual. The point is to understand what conversations you can have in a building and what conversations can you have online. And guess what? How many conversations can you have with a catalog? I want stuff. Good luck. Right? Conversations include the language that we exchange. These conversants are using language. And the language matters a lot. Why is it that people can't have a conversation with a catalog? Because they don't know the language. There's study after study that says that users might as well be shot in the head, fall face down on the keyboard, and do just as well finding an object in your catalog as actually trying to type something. But then you guys are like rocket scientists. You can actually go into a catalog and somehow create life. It's an amazing thing. Skynet becomes self-aware. Why is it? Well, the short answer is no one is born speaking Boolean. Right? How was your day? My day was good. And it was fun. Are you sure it wasn't core fun? Well, it wasn't sore fun for sure, but extra points for anyone who knows Zor. All right. Exclusive Or. It's fun. It's Venn diagrams. I hate Venn diagrams. Anyway, language matters. Reference folks know this all the time, right? Reference know that when people show up at the desk, they are not ready to tell you what they need, right? The first part of a conversation is trying to figure out, well, who the hell are you? Someone once said, I learned in library school to never ask anyone why they need information. And I said, how do you know that? Because I asked that once and someone told me. Joe James tells the story about how he gets an email at Internet Public Library and talks about, I need to know the incubation period of herpes. And then goes into very specific and graphic detail about his marital relationship, physical anatomy, to figure it out. Right? Language matters. How do we talk to our folks? Here's one. Do you have, what do you call people who use the library? What do you call people who come into your library? What do you call them? Patrons? Customers? Users? Clients? I got one for you. Mary Brian Williams had this issue. She was working on strategic planning, and they came to this point. And she said, I have this radical idea. Let's go ask them. Overwhelming their answer? Members. I got a card. I pay taxes, I pay tuition, I pay something, I'm a member. Think about the difference between member and customer or user. Very different. Very different. I think that as librarians, is our ultimate goal to prepare better customers? Is our goal as librarians to prepare a society that consumes better? Or is our goal to create people who learn and control their destiny, control their knowledge, and improve their community? So what I want you to think about is every time you hear the word user, throw the word member in there. If it doesn't work, I got a member of a database, it doesn't work.
ask how participatory that technology is. Ask how involved they are in it. Ask how invested they are in it.
So if you have users of your libraries, what does that mean when you need them? What is that relationship that you have to them? I believe that libraries are of communities, not for communities. Which means as a library improves, the community improves. As the community improves, the library improves. Versus, well, we can outsource that because you're just for us.
It's the difference between the word service and servant. So what are we exchanging this language for? We're seeking agreements. Do you believe me? Does that make sense? Do you understand? Right? And the most important agreement? Agree not to agree. Well, we just can't agree on that. Does that mean we stop or we can move on? And lastly, memory. That we remember things. Right? That we remember these agreements over time. And memory is a very interesting thing. Memory doesn't work the way that libraries work. Memory in your brain is not a series of shelves that you slot new knowledge into. Memory is chaotic and crazy and interconnected. Right? It's why you can't remember a really good joke when you hear it. But the way you remember things is you look for a pattern. Your brain wants a pattern and it stores it. So if you hear a really good joke, really good jokes, by and large, are based on screwing you at the end. Here's an example. Woman goes into the grocery store, says, I'd like a pound of broccoli, please. The grocer says, I'm sorry, we're out of broccoli. Would you like some cauliflower? Woman says, I love cauliflower, but I'll just take the pound of broccoli. Grocer says, I'm sorry, we're out of broccoli. I've got some spinach. Would you like some spinach? Oh, spinach is delightful. I'll just take the pound of broccoli. Grocer says, no broccoli, but we've got some green beans. Oh, green beans are fantastic. I'll just take the pound. Lady, can you spell cat as in catastrophic? For sure. C-A-T. Can you spell dog as in dogmatic? She goes, absolutely. D-O-G. Can you spell stink as in broccoli? She goes, hey, there is no stink in broccoli. She goes, that's what I'm trying to say. Now, my son gets the fact that there's a pattern. He gets the setup, but he doesn't understand the twist at the end. So he'll take jokes like, knock, knock, who's there, dog who ran over the road just for fun. I don't know why. Okay, right? That's not how your memory works. It wants to relate things. It wants to bring things together. Now, what are the implications for the fact that this is how people learn, how people understand things? Well, the implications are, first of all, a conversation is co-owned. If what you're learning, if what how people are learning, you co-own that. Right now, you are deciding whether to listen to me or not. There's quite literally an infinite number of things you could be paying attention to, from the color of the walls to the buzzing sound to what's that stick up there to what are they doing in the background to what my email's in front of me. You are choosing where to put your attention. Right? And as a librarian, we realize that now the most scarce thing that we deal with is not stuff. It's not information, whatever information is. It's not web pages or books or database access. The most expensive, exclusive, and precious resource that we now caretake or people's attention. In reference, we do not give answers, we do not give information, we caretake someone's attention. In cataloging, when you catalog a book and you add all those wonderful little keywords and such, what you're trying to do is call and utilize people's attention. How can I get them to the thing they need the most? That precious attention resource is something that is co-owned. You can't teach someone, you can only facilitate them learning. That knowledge is not co-owned. That is, that we all have a crazy, very unique information, and it can never be recorded. There is no such thing as recorded knowledge. It's like intelligent rock. It doesn't exist. You can record information that someone can take and use to create new information. But the knowledge is up here. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let's take a look at what I just did at the beginning. We started at the Library of Alexandria. We ended up with Dr. Pepper. We went back and looked at maps. And finally, we ended up with, like, bare-breasted gods from Egypt. This is not what normal people think about when they think about the Library of Alexandria. But this is my conception. It may have nothing to do with yours. And that's okay, because what ultimately we're going to do is engage in a conversation where we're going to try and mesh those things together. librarians within organizations, be they city government, be they schools, be they universities, be they state government, our job is to knit these various and unique information, this knowledge, together. We are CIOs, chief integration officers. This is why things like authority control doesn't work. This is why when you look at Julie and you say, what the hell is cookery? Right? Really? As an industrial art? Right? It's why when you look at how people organize the information, universal classification doesn't work. It's broken. We know it's broken. We try throwing tags at things. We try creating pathfinders to things. Because a universal understanding of how the world works is beyond what libraries do. What's ironic is that libraries are credible agents. We're important because we believe in authority, but we believe it by being authoritative. We want to gain your trust because we show you multiple viewpoints and you trust us. Not being authoritarian. This is the right way. This is how you understand it. When someone comes into our library, we don't say, you're wrong, we're going to make you right. We come in and say, what's your question? Let's get you the best answer. That's a very different world. So why is it that we turn around and go, but when you want to organize all the information in the world, that is a right way or a wrong way. Right? It breaks down. It's why, for example, when we look at two different sites, they don't necessarily work the same way. This is two different encyclopedia sites. This is in 1994? 2004. We're going to go to 2004. Wikipedia launches. When did Wikipedia launch? Actually, it is probably 1994-ish. Wikipedia, Microsoft, and Carter. Two sites. Who would you have guessed would win this war? Now you say,
Wikipedia, duh.
No. Take it back, Terrence. Who was going to win this war? Was it going to be at the time, the largest technology company in the world that had an active and dominant share of the market in encyclopedias in the K-12 world, that had an amazing value chain in it, that had the best editors in the world, that could buy any content they wanted, or a bunch of Yahoos with a PHP script that said, hey, someone do what you want. And if you're saying, I knew that Wikipedia was going to do it, you are lying. Because I certainly didn't. I mean, how many of you were called up by the local paper and go, so Wikipedia is in fact a betrayal of all that we know that is true, right? Not so much. Number one reference resource in question point virtual record service around the world? Wikipedia. Right? Number one non-cited resource in every student in the world? Wikipedia. Had someone write a report, they called it the resource that shall not be named. But so why is it that if we then look over a couple of years, Wikipedia goes crazy and the Carta shuts down? Now, in retrospect, you say, well, because it was social. Like, for sure. Really? If you follow the landmark, you may still be working on your GeoCities homepage for your library, making sure that it links to your Friendster account and can show your cool background in MySpace. Right? Now, we look at that as the internet equivalent of bell bottoms and leisure suits now. But the thing is, a lot of people own bell bottoms and leisure suits at the time. Right? How do we pick it? If we stay near the shore and look for our landmarks, we don't always end up in the right place because we don't know what variables matter. Who knew that crowdsourcing was such a powerful concept at the time? Well, if you look at it from a conversational standpoint, show up, ask a question, and shut up. Or show up, and if you don't find it, add it. Engage editors. This is a conversational approach. If this is how people learn, it makes sense. Why does Facebook go crazy? Is it because people want to do vanity press? No, it's because they can build the site around them. They can look at their world and say, my world is these 12 people and Farmville. And I can look at it and say, no, it's these 12 people and Mahjong Dimensions. And it's these 12. And if you look at your Facebook page, it's you. It's because it shaped you. And when Facebook betrays that, when Facebook calls you on it and says, no, it's really us, look at the world and what they do. Oh, hell no. You're not taking that privacy setting. Right? Microsoft changes the setting, you just click say okay, because you're used to being abused. whatever it is. By the way, if you'd like, I could use an Apple example, but you know, just keep going. So, what is it that we want to do, right? Why then do I see so many Facebook pages that look like this? Facebook, my friend, the building, that has, let's see, 36 friends, and what can they do? They can maybe say they're annoyed or something, or they can search the catalog. So we're going to go into a place that's all about conversation, communication, community, and we're going to let them search stuff. What's wrong with this picture? People on Facebook, they want to talk about books, talk about, look at library thing. Library thing is not about the stuff, it's about the conversation around the stuff. It's not about books, it's about people who want to be bookish. Right? Very different world. We're supporting conversations, not stuff. So what is a librarian in a world like this? If it's not the stuff, if it's not our collections, if it's not our materials, if it's not our catalog, what the hell are we that makes us a librarian? What is that theme that has followed us for 3,000 years and allowed us to stay as librarians? I would tell you it's a common mission. The mission of librarians is to improve society. Feel free to stop it there. Through facilitating knowledge creation in your communities. The tools and the books and the databases and the materials and the place are tools to facilitate knowledge creation. When people had to make decisions and they couldn't afford $1 million databases to do it, the tool we chose was cooperative buying. When people couldn't make good decisions because they didn't have access to enough documented materials, we bought the materials. We lobbied Congress for the information. We went out and we collected stuff. But now that they can get to all of that, does that mean that our job's done? Far from it. Now our job is to facilitate that conversation. Access is only one and frankly a very poor method of doing knowledge. You take a 3-year-old into the stack and you leave them for a week and you come back, they will not read. Actually, most of your places they probably will read because you've adopted them and given them a cat. I'm so happy that there's amazing cat people here. It means access is important, yes. Access to what? The book? Access to the conversation. Why is it different giving someone a textbook as if they want to learn about physics and bringing them to a website as talking to a physicist in a local community or in the university? Those are tools and methods that you facilitate. Access, knowledge, and environment. Why are we so worried about the Patriot Act? Because it creates a chilling effect. Because part of what libraries do is they produce a safe environment. Intellectually safe, physically safe. You know that in some of your libraries, they come to your library because they can't go from work, or they can't go from school to home without a safe place. You know that in some of your libraries, people come to use the computer because they can't search at home. Some amazing work about librarians work with abused women. One of the most, the scariest times when a woman finally decides to leave an abusive relationship. That's when most of the tragedies occur. And so if they search for shelters and search for airline flights and search MapQuest at home on a computer that their abusive husband can see, it's dangerous. So we provide a safe place that not only can they come search that, but we promise not to tell anyone else. An environment in which they can do it. And finally, we provide and understand motivation. Why are they here? What are they doing? How can we solve this problem? We understand that when someone comes to the reference desk and they want to know Britney Spears' birthday just because they happen to be walking by the reference desk, we really don't need to spend 12 hours and come up with a comprehensive pathfinder that involves 500 citations. Right? Here. But we understand when someone comes here and they want to start a business and they have no clue, then in fact we have to go further than what their question is. So we understand what motivates them. And if we don't understand what motivates them, we don't get anywhere. So ultimately, what makes an awesome library? What makes an awesome library? This is the current webpage for the new Library of Alexandria. What was amazing is during the revolution, during the amazing, amazing revolution, where, as someone said it, for the first time in the 7,000-year history of a country, a leader was deposed by popular demand. As the demonstrations were going on in Alexandria, the protesters linked hands and surrounded the library so it would not be touched. Not one pane of glass,
Not one rock was thrown at the Library of Alexandria.
Was it because of the stuff in it?
Sure.
Was it because of the people in it?
Yes.
Was it because those people looked at their library as the aspiration, as the best of themselves?
Did they look at that library not as a service, but as part of their identity, as part of their community, as an essential component of the conversation of what it meant to be Egyptian?
That's what an awesome librarian is about. Someone who brings about a world that is so powerful that people are willing to stand up and defend it. That people are willing to say, this library is important because it is me. Because it is our community, because we are a better community if we're here. And that won't happen if it's just about the stuff. No one will pick it when Borders closes. No one will lock themselves to the door of a closing Blockbuster and say, no, you shall not pass. They'll run in and they'll buy as many cheap books and cheap videos as they can. But what happens when they try and close a library? You go, well, sure, okay, come on, Egypt. And Camden. And New Jersey. And Boston. And Pittsburgh. And your libraries? What makes an awesome librarian is that they are so in touch with their community that the community understands that they are poor without it. And that doesn't happen by blogging, though you will blog. And it doesn't happen by tweeting, though you will tweet. It doesn't happen by how beautiful your catalog is or how delightful your website is or even how technically proficient it is. This comes from you, so tied in and knowledgeable of your community, so important to your community, such an asset to your community that they can't imagine it without you. To be an awesome librarian today, whether you have a degree or not, whether you call yourself a librarian or not, is all about knowing the community, having them participate, and being part of that. And every one of you has the ability to do it. You've all taken the first step today. You've all stood up and said, we want to be leaders. We want to learn this. Take advantage of this opportunity. Shut off email. Shut off the phone. Not because it's going to drive you nuts. Sneak it during the break. But because this is what you want to be. You want to be the place that helps communities learn. You want to facilitate knowledge creation. You want to ultimately improve society, not simply pass it by and document it. That's what we are. That's what makes us vital. The future of this profession is not in what we can buy and collect and put into a system. It is not the interfaces that we can create. It is you on the ground, talking, working, and making life a better place. And everyone in this room can do that. And everyone in this room has that ability. And we're going to do our damnedest to help you realize it. Thank you very much.